This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, economics professor and radio host Rick Wolf joins us once again to talk about the recent economic situation.
What's going on when we go from fiscal cliff to sequestration? What kind of word is that? Here's Rick Wolf to again tell us about austerity carried out on the backs of the poor.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Heidi, I understand that there have been reports of police firing a gun without justification.
Michael, it seems it happens every day. This case is a little unusual, however, because the officer in question is Ivan, and he's a three-year German Shepherd who was searching for a gun in a snowbank in Lawrence, Massachusetts, when he accidentally pulled the trigger with his paw and the weapon discharged. Now, fortunately, no humans or canine units were harmed in this incident, but it's believed to be the first case in which a dog officer has fired a weapon.
I have a question for you. It was buried by three people or something that they've arrested?
Yes. The episode actually started a week or two ago when an officer heard three gunshots. He went to investigate, saw a car speeding away, and he saw a man leap out and put something in the snow. That's when Ivan was called to the scene to sniff around that snowbank.
Now, here's the question I have for you that goes to that. You know, there's this rule called felony murder. And if three of us have a gun, and even if I, you know, didn't intend to shoot it, and one of my co-conspirators shoots it, I can be convicted of felony murder because someone is carrying a gun on a felony. So the question I have is, these three guys are there. This dog fires the gun by accident, or however he hits his paw, maybe on purpose, he's trained. And someone would have gotten killed when he fired the gun. Would that have been felony murder when the dog actually fired the gun?
No, because the dog is an officer, and as everyone who listens to our show knows, it is very rare that an officer is found to be complicit in a crime.
No, I'm not asking about the officer.
Oh.
The three men who buried the gun would be... It doesn't
yes.
make any difference who shoots the
oh,
gun.
Oh, right. That's right. Felony murder.
Even though the dog shot
Good
the gun,
point.
The guys would be
right.
convicted
Good
of
point.
Felony
I
murder.
Think that that's one lesson that our audience should take home, and I think the other one is that there should have been a proper background check on this dog.
Well, because, Michael, as you say, the dog is usually supposed to go to the spot when he sniffs or she sniffs something, lie down, and sit there when he finds the so-called article, as they refer to it. This dog violated procedure.
It's a dog-eat-dog world.
All I can say to that, Heidi, is woof.
Now, I went down to Fort Meade to hear Bradley Manning speak in court. I'd been there once before when he described the torture and his imprisonment. It was one of the more moving days I ever spent in court. And likewise, when he read his statement pleading guilty, it was also incredibly moving. The first thing you have to understand is reading a statement on a guilty plea is unusual. Normally, the judge just asks you questions. How do you plead? Why? What did you do? But she actually let him read a 35-page, two-hour statement. And it was extraordinary in the court. Before I go to what that statement is, which is what I want to describe, I want to say what he did. In a normal case, when you make a guilty plea, you have an agreement with at least the prosecutor saying, the prosecutor says, yes, I'll accept that guilty plea, we'll plead to this, and you'll either have a deal with the judge in state courts or oftentimes in federal courts, at least you'll have an idea of what you may get sentenced to. In a military trial, what Bradley Manning did in a military court-martial, what he did was what's called a naked guilty plea. It's very unusual because he didn't have an agreement from the prosecutor, which means that whatever he pleads guilty to, the prosecutor can say, well, that's not good enough for me. I still want the higher charges. So in this case, the higher charges are two, espionage, the highest degree of espionage, which is material related to the national defense that harms the United States, and aiding the enemy. And for those, he could get life imprisonment, and in fact, in one case, death penalty, except that the U.S. has said they're not going to ask for the death penalty.
Couldn't the content of what he read go to negate intent on those higher charges?
It's a tricky question about intent and what the intent had to be. The judge has pretty well ruled out that he had to have, this is a lawyerly, specific intent. It's enough if he knew that this information was going to, quote, Al-Qaeda through my client, WikiLeaks. But the point is he took a risk in doing this. The risk is, first, that the prosecutor wouldn't agree and would say, I'm going to charge you with espionage and aiding the enemy anyway. And secondly, which is a risk he took, is that the elements he pleaded to can then be used by the prosecutor to prove the higher charges. And the judge explained this very carefully. She said, look, you understand, if you plead guilty to transmitting information to WikiLeaks, if the prosecutor then wants to prove that you aided the enemy, she already has an element, or he already has an element, the prosecutor, which is that you transmitted the information to WikiLeaks, which is the first step on proving espionage or aiding the enemy. And Bradley Manning said he understood it. His voice was clear. He's very smart, highly intelligent, but he decided to take the risk anyway. My guess is, and I don't know this, is that he took the risk because he was not getting any kind of deal out of the prosecutor. The prosecutor was going to go for the life sentence, and this was sort of his only effort to try and maybe push this idea a little bit more, that he shouldn't be found guilty of these very high charges. I also think, and again, I don't know this, is that he wanted to put his political reasons for doing what he did on the record. And it's extraordinary what he said. You have to understand, this young man was 20 when he went into the military. He started seeing the crimes of the United States by the time he's 22, and he decides he's going to reveal those crimes through the medium of WikiLeaks. Highly political. This was not the person that's been painted of a depressed person who's not clear about his sexuality, and that was the factor or the reason for doing it. And I don't want to spend a lot of time here on this update, but I just want to give you, our listeners, a sense of what he said for each of the documents he gave a political reason. So the first one that he uploaded, the first set, are called the Iraq War Logs and the Afghan War Logs. Those are called SIGACs, they're Significant Activities Logs, and they're the ones that are the daily logs of all the attacks going on. He looks at these attacks, and he says, this is stuff that people, the American people, ought to debate. And here's what he said. I began to think about what I knew and the information I had in my possession. For me, the SIGACs, the Significant Acts, represented the on-the-ground reality of both the Afghan conflicts and the Iraq conflict. I felt we were risking so much for people that seemed unwilling to cooperate with us, leading to frustration and anger on both sides. I began to become depressed with the situation that we found ourselves increasingly mired in year after year. In attempting to conduct counterterrorism and counterinsurgency, the operations we became obsessed with, capturing and killing human targets on lists and not being suspicious of and avoiding cooperation with our host nation partners, and ignoring the second and third order effects of accomplishing short-term goals and missions. I believe if the general public, especially the American public, had access to the information contained within these reports, this could spark domestic debate on the role of the military and our foreign policy in general, as well as how it related to Iraq and Afghanistan. I also believe the detailed analysis of the data over a long period of time by different sectors of society might cause society to reevaluate the need or even the desire to engage in counterterrorism and counterinsurgency operations that ignore the complex dynamics of the people living in the affected environment every day. So that's his statement on those. And he ends, after he uploads them, and he uploads them to WikiLeaks, and he had them on an SD card like you have in your camera. He was in Maryland. There was a blizzard. Internet in his house where he was living, his aunt's house, went out. He went to a Barnes & Noble and uploaded them to WikiLeaks from there, hundreds of thousands of documents. And what he said after that, I felt a sense of relief by having done it. I felt I'd accomplished something that allowed me to have a clear conscience based on what I had seen and read about and knew what was happening in both Iraq and Afghanistan every day. That's one set of documents. I could go on like that for each set. I'll read one more of the political reasons that he gave. He uploads the what we now call the collateral murder video. That's the video of two Reuters journalists being killed from what's called an aerial gunship. Then the rescue van that's coming to help the wounded crawling along the ground, is then fired upon by the same aerial gunship. And of course, that video is never released to Reuters. CENTCOM, which is the central command of the military, it gets back to Reuters and say, well, we can't find it. At the same time, it's floating all over Iraq, where these young analysts like Bradley Manning are. Here's what Bradley Manning says about seeing it. The fact that neither CENTCOM nor the multinational force in Iraq would not voluntarily release the video troubled me further. It was clear to me that the event happened because the aerial weapons team mistakenly identified Reuters employees as a potential threat, and that people in the bongo truck, that's the van, were merely attempting to assist the wounded. The people in the van were not a threat, but merely, quote, good Samaritans. The most alarming aspect of the video to me, however, was the seemingly delightful bloodlust those in the aerial helicopter appeared to have. They dehumanized the individuals they were engaging and seemed to not value human life by referring to them as, quote, dead bastards, and congratulating each other on the ability to kill in large numbers. At one point in the video, there's an individual on the ground attempting to crawl to safety. The individual is seriously wounded. Instead of calling for medical attention to the location, one of the aerial weapons team crew members verbally asks for the wounded person to pick up a weapon so that he can have a reason to engage. For me, this seems similar to a child torturing ants with a magnifying glass. So that's the Bradley Manning, the person I came away from that hearing saying, this statement should be read by every school child in America, because it shows what someone with a conscience can do and can act upon, rather than just looking the other way and doing something else. Read by every college student, read by every American. Bradley Manning came away from that hearing and this statement as a true hero of America.
Like a modern time Patrick Henry. He's a great young man. And the government is now equating whistleblowers with treason.
The risk he took, at least in terms of the, to get the government not to go further, did not pay off. The government announced the next day after this statement that they were going forward with the aiding the enemy charge and with espionage.
In the courtroom, Michael, as you looked around, what were the reactions from the judge and the people in the courtroom, if any, to his reading?
Well, you know, the judge and Bradley Manning seemed to have a certain rapport and were talking directly to each other. He was sitting at a table in front of her. He was 10 feet from me. The courtroom is minuscule. And they had a rapport with each other, and she kept asking him questions about it, and two were interesting. On one question she asked him, which I don't have the quote in front of me, was, can you tell me what was the content of a particular document? And Bradley Manning says, I can't tell you that because that's classified. So here you have the judge asking him material about material that's classified, and Manning is saying, I can't tell you that. That was a moment of, I wouldn't say hilarity would be too strong a word, but of fun in the courtroom. And another point, she's on each charge, she has to ask him, she explains there's a justification defense and there's a necessity defense that you could have made a trial. But you're waiving that by doing this. But I have to ask you about it because what you've said in each of these cases and what the government kept raising is basically put forward a reason for doing it. You have to ask him about, do you think it was justified or do you think it was necessary to do this? And of course, that's the second part of the afternoon when I'm there. And because he's making a guilty plea that has to be accepted, he has to say, I don't think there was a legal justification for doing it, and I don't think there's a necessity for doing it, and therefore I keep pleading guilty. But of course, had there been a trial, those would have been the defenses that were offered.
Can we link to Bradley Manning's statement on lawanddisorder.org?
Yeah, we will link to the statement. You can go there. It's absolutely worth reading. It's incredible. As I said, it should be read by everyone who believes that you can just sit there and watch violence, criminality continue and not take action. We welcome economics professor and the radio host of Economic Update, Rick Wolf, back to our show to discuss the current billion-dollar cuts known as the sequester. The sequester is a major reduction in U.S. military and domestic spending of up to $85 billion. Particularly, the cuts in domestic spending are a massive austerity policy that will send ripple effects throughout the U.S. economy. Professor Wolf will discuss the effects of this sequester, the reasons for it, and what its effects will be on the United States and around the world.
Rick Wolf, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael. Glad to be here.
Yesterday, the Dow Jones average went through the roof, higher than it's been in 5 years. At the same time, you have huge unemployment, you have a huge housing crisis, you have what the government calls sequestration, which we're going to ask you about. What's going on?
Well, we've had basically the same story for most of the last 5 years. Let's begin by remembering that this crisis technically starts at the last quarter of 2007, which means we're now in the sixth year of this crisis. The stock market has recovered in the sense that it has hit a level of roughly what it was in 2007 before this crisis hit. And that kind of improvement is also found in profitability of financial and indeed other kinds of corporations in the United States. So if you are an employer, at least a big one, and if you are an owner of shares of stock, you've now come back. It's taken 6 years to do it. You've recovered where you were back in 2007, which isn't terrible, but it isn't very great either that it took this long. No one predicted a crisis of this depth. No one predicted a crisis of this length, or almost no one. And as a result, we are now looking at basically 6 years of loss for the corporations and the stockholders. But they are a tiny portion of the American people, those employers and those shareholders. They don't amount to a significant number of our people. How have the others, the rest of us, the 99%, or at least the 90%, how have we done? And there the answer is unambiguously, we're not even remotely close to a recovery. I'd give you a couple of signs of it, just not to take too much time. One is unemployment. The unemployment rate in 2007, before this began, averaged under 5%. Around 4.8, 4.9. At its worst moment in this crisis, 2009 and 10, unemployment hit 10%. Where are we today? Barely under 8%. We're not even halfway back today to where we were back in 2007 when there were millions of people unemployed, so it's nothing to boast about anyway. So there is no recovery whatsoever in the realm of unemployment. And in fact, the unemployment number I just gave you understates the problem because large numbers of people have left the labor market and therefore aren't counted among the unemployed, but those are mostly people who looked for a long time and basically gave up.
So what's the real level of unemployment, Rick?
It depends on how you measure. Actually, the Bureau of Labor Statistics in Washington uses a number of different ways of counting unemployment. And the one that most of us use who are professional economists is their statistic called U-6, unemployment statistic number 6, because they have so many. And that one measures the following: the number of people without work who are looking for a job. That's the conventional unemployment number, but they add two other people. One, those who have left the labor force. They're considered marginal to the labor force. They're added. And finally, those who have a part-time job involuntarily. That is, they want a full-time job and they can't get it. Those three groups are considered what you ought to look at. And there, the measurement is not the roughly 8% of the unemployed, but it's roughly double that, between 15 and 16% of the American people. So you're saying that one out of six people in the labor force is in those categories: unemployed, marginalized, or involuntarily part-time, which means every single family in the United States, on average, has a person in it that is going through this process and therefore becoming a burden on the rest of the family. In short, unemployment is very bad right now and affecting every American family, and there's nothing remotely recovery about any of that. And let me give you a second statistic. A few days ago, the New York Times carried it, which, you know, is 3 or 4 months after everybody else knew about it. But in any case, it's a measurement of capital flows in the world. Capital flows in the world measure how much trade there is, how much movement of actual economic life is happening between Europe and China and the United States and Latin America. It's down 61% now compared to what it was in 2007. No recovery whatsoever in the international flow, which is extremely important in order to move economic well-being from those areas where there is some economic growth, China being the best example, to the rest of the world. And that isn't happening. And as a result, anyone who follows the stock market or is interested in that should be extremely wary, which even the most conventional stock analysts are these days, that this is a stock market that seems to believe that it doesn't have to worry where the mass of people are, doesn't have to worry about their diminished purchasing power.
Rick, I got a $2 word for you, sequestration, now that it's fallen on us. It seems to me that it was a bipartisan deal. It was signed into law by Obama. It's going to have some terrible effects, particularly on poorer people. Where did this come from? Is this a version of what we see in Europe, say in Greece or Spain, which they call over there austerity?
Absolutely. The United States is pursuing an austerity policy. It's basically the same as in Europe. The difference is we're uncomfortable with that word because it sounds bad, and we don't want to be doing anything bad in America. So it becomes fiscal responsibility or prudent government management or other glossy phrases, but it's all austerity. So let's begin, make sure everybody knows what austerity is, and then I'll take you through how we got to sequestration. Austerity is a very simple idea. It has two parts. You raise taxes on average people, that's part one, and part two is you cut government spending throughout the economy. You do one or the other, or typically combinations of both, and that's called austerity. That's what they've been doing in Greece for the last 3 years, that's what they've been doing in England for the last 3 years, and France, and Portugal, and Italy, and on and on and on. And we're doing it too. Two, in this explanation. Austerity has been a policy agreed to by Republicans and Democrats alike. There is no debate in this country, at least as far as the two parties are concerned, about austerity. The only disagreement that the Republicans and Democrats have is exactly what mixture of tax increases on everybody and government cutbacks are going to be done. The Democrats want a little different mix. They would like, for example, to rely a bit more on tax increases rather than government spending. And they throw into the mix, particularly Obama, hyping it beyond all words, a little bit of a tax on the rich. I'll come back to that because that really has all the genuineness of a $4 bill. But we'll come back to it. So in 2011, when both parties agreed on austerity, they couldn't agree on the details. And so they did this peculiar thing late in 2011. They said, we can't agree, but we have to agree because we have to come to some conclusion. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to make a temporary measure, and we're going to give ourselves a deadline of December 31st, 2012. If we don't come to an agreement on a combination of tax increases and spending cuts, then an automatic set of them will go into effect. Automatic. So this crazy behavior in which people who can't agree punish themselves about not agreeing by agreeing to do something that they couldn't agree to do, and if it sounds weird, welcome to American politics. That's what they agreed to do. And we saw it all hyped up with full political theater at the end of 2012, last December, when the name of the game was not austerity, but fiscal cliff. We were all told horror stories that we were all as a nation, like the proverbial lemmings, going to be going over the cliff to our doom and disaster. What was happening was the people in politics were realizing, since they couldn't agree any more in 2012 than they had been able to in 2011, they were facing the automatic cuts. So they made a last-minute, fully choreographed agreement on half the package. They would deal with the taxes by December 31st, and they would put off until March 1st, 2013, the other side, the spending cuts. So what did they do in December 31st? And bear with me, I know it's taken a minute of time,
but it's very interesting.
It'll make it real clear to you. Here's the deal they cut at the end of December. They would raise taxes, which, as I say, is what every austerity policy does. And they basically raised two taxes. One that raised a ton of money and is very important and got no publicity, and another one that is minuscule and unimportant and that got all the publicity. So first the one that got the publicity, taxing the rich, led by the president in full force as a public speaker. We were told that he was going to tax the rich, and the Republicans played their assigned role. You mustn't tax the rich. And after all the dust settled and they agreed not to go over the cliff, saving us Americans from this manufactured piece of theater, here's what they decided. All people earning, all couples that earn more than $450,000 a year, that was the cutoff. Anybody earning less than $450,000, which is 99% of our people, were not affected by this tax the rich. Only those above $450,000. And here's what happened to them. Instead of the 35% rate they paid in 2012, under the deal that was struck, it was raised all the way to 39.6%, an increase of 4.6% just on the dollars above 450 that rich people earn, just on that amount, not the first 450. Those are not touched by this. So only about no rich person in that category will do anything other than laugh all the way to the bank that this was called an attack on the rich. And let's keep in mind that in 1950s and 60s, the top income tax bracket that such people had to pay was 91%. So keep that in mind. They now pay 39.6. You're not taxing the rich, not even close. And it doesn't raise a significant amount of money anyway. Meanwhile, the other tax that didn't get publicity, but that the Republicans and Democrats agreed on and the president signed, was an increase in the payroll tax in the United States. It went from 4.2% to 6.2%. 150 million Americans get paychecks every week, and those paychecks are smaller as of January 1 because instead of having 4.2 taken out for your Social Security contribution, that's what a payroll tax is, they take out now 6.2%.
Let me ask one question about that, because I saw that, and that did get a little bit of reading if you read carefully. There was complaints by like Walmart and everything saying our sales are going to go down because people have $20 less a week.
Absolutely. For the energy companies, it means people are going to economize more on buying gasoline, which is very expensive, because you're talking about more Americans than ever are at the margin, and you're taking more than $20. You're taking a good $1,000. If you think that the roughly just median income or whatever it is,
yeah, 20
family,
times 50 is 1,000.
There we go. It's $1,000.
I did that math.
Good for you. $1,000. You know, for people on the edge, $1,000 pulled out of their salary. You know, that's a significant amount of money, and it's mind-bending. That's an increase, if you do the math, of over 45% increase in this tax, which 150 million Americans, effectively everybody, is now forced to pay. It raises over $125 billion. It is a very significant tax, and it falls on the most regressive tax we have at the federal level. There's nothing progressive about it. In fact, it's so regressive, let me drive home the point. Everybody who earns anywhere between $1 a year and $113,000, that's the cutoff, per year, went from 4.2% to 6.2%. Anybody who earns more than that, you only pay on the first 113. So if, for example, you're one of those rich people with 450, you don't pay the increase on every dollar you get above 113. So the bulk of your income is unaffected if you're rich. So not only did the rich get an increase that's minuscule, but they escaped the increase on the mass of Americans. If you understand this, you will understand what austerity is. It's whacking the mass of people to raise the money to offset the costs to the government of the crisis that these massive people had nothing to do with bringing, and the bailouts, which were neatly organized to bypass the very people now being taxed.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Thank you. Just joining us, we're talking with economics professor Rick Wolf.
So, Rick, essentially we're talking semantics on the part of the government because we have taxed the 99 or the 90%, as you say. We're just coming out of payroll and they're not talking about it that way.
That's right. It's basically a tax on the mass of people, which is what they're doing in Greece and in England and in Ireland and in Portugal. So regressive, let me drive home the point. Everybody who earns anywhere between $1 a year and $113,000, that's the cutoff, per year, went from 4.2% to 6.2%. Anybody who earns more than that, you only pay on the first 113. So if, for example, you're one of those rich people with 450, you don't pay the increase on every dollar you get above 113. So the bulk of your income is unaffected if you're rich. So not only did the rich get an increase that's minuscule, but they escaped the increase on the mass of Americans. If you understand this, you will understand what austerity is. It's whacking the mass of people to raise the money to offset the costs to the government of the crisis that these massive people had nothing to do with bringing, and the bailouts, which were neatly organized to bypass the very people now being taxed.
So, Rick, essentially we're talking semantics on the part of the government because we have taxed the 99 or the 90%, as you say. We're just coming out of payroll, and they're not talking about it that way.
That's right. It's basically a tax on the mass of people, which is what they're doing in Greece and in England and in Ireland and in Portugal. We're doing the same thing.
But that's step one. That's December 31, 2012. Right. That's half of the so-called fiscal
cliff.
I'm going to get to part two. I just want to remind our listeners where we are in this conversation.
They were so incapable in 2011 to come to an agreement, so they imposed this thing and we had the fiscal cliff theater. But they couldn't go beyond the tax part. They couldn't deal with the spending part. So they came up with another weird piece of theater. They postponed the fiscal cliff so that it would affect spending, which they hadn't been able to agree on. And they gave themselves a limit of March 1st, 2013, this last week. So now we could go through the same theater again. But this time we invented a new word. Instead of saying fiscal cliff, which kind of people had come to understand, they called it the sequester. I mean, a choice of language that somebody in a mental institution came up with. But in any case, so it was called the sequester, but don't get lost on the word. The word is unimportant. All it meant was if the government didn't reach an agreement the way they did at the last minute for taxes, well, then these automatic cuts, which had actually been written in back in the autumn of 2011 when this whole thing was set up, would kick in. Well, they failed to reach an agreement, and so the sequester, this fiscal cliff, this automatic punish us if we don't do something kind of approach actually went into effect on March 1st, and it's an across-the-board cut in government spending, including both defense, which is unusual in our history, and all the non-defense, all the discretionary and other kinds of expenditures, exempting food stamps, Social Security, and a couple of others. But they can, the Congress, if they reach an agreement next week, next month, or any other time, they can abort this whole thing. They can prevent it from continuing. So it's a little bit of a game. We've imposed this thing on us, but we can relieve the imposition at any time.
I understand that. Now, one thing in terms of the way they set it up, which I read in the paper, and I don't know how true it is, because we're getting all these false pictures of the fight between the Republicans and the Democrats, they said that the Republicans essentially tricked Obama, that they agreed to sequester the military, cut back on the military, and cut back on domestic spending. Obama obviously, or at least obviously people believe, didn't want to cut back on domestic spending, but didn't think the Republicans would in the end ever agree to the cuts on the military. So when the quote cliff came up, the Republicans says, we don't care about the military, cut it, and then Obama had nobody to negotiate with. That's the way I read the New York Times on it. What's wrong with that? What's right about it?
I think that nobody really particularly cares. Even the military have made it crystal clear. and people should understand this, from Panetta, the defense secretary, on down, the military doesn't want or need a good bit of the spending geared up to be given to it. It's not the military that wants it. It is the congressional representation from the companies with the military contracts who want it. And so we have this bizarre display. We've had it for years, in which the military gives testimony. We don't need this program. We don't need that tank. We don't need that piece of aircraft. And the senators and the congressmen and women sit there, listen to them, and vote it anyway, because they're not, no one gives a damn in Congress about whether you need it or not. They want the jobs and the profits of the defense contractors who are funding their political campaigns to be protected. And so they're protecting that with the same alacrity and the same intensity that they protect all other kinds of programs. But with actual defense, it has little to do. So you're not going to force the Republicans in a way around this game.
So now you're going to the consequences of the
Let's talk about it. If the cuts happen, right. Again, the logic here is very clear, and people should understand it, because about austerity again. This is the policy that was followed in Greece. They've been collapsing ever since. It's the policy followed by the conservative Cameron government in the United Kingdom, and they're now in the second downturn of this great recession. And it's true in Portugal. It's true in Italy. It is transforming politics in these countries, shaking up their society, convulsing them in general strikes and demonstrations on a daily basis. Last weekend, for example, were the largest demonstrations in Lisbon in the history of Portugal. So you have a crisis in which the people who run the society are so determined to stay on top, even though their machinations brought the crisis, even though they got their governments to bail them out as priority number one, now that it comes time to pay for some of this, they're determined. Taxes will not go up on rich people, and the money to pay for this will be raised by taxing the masses and cutting government spending on programs for the masses, and let the devil take the hindmost. That's the plan, and that's what austerity is about.
Rick, I read in the paper that with the tax increases on the rich and with the government cuts, that this over the years would get rid of the deficit. But what I'm hearing you say is that that's only one side of the equation, and they're sort of presenting it that way to call this a success.
And that's exactly what they did in Greece and Ireland and Britain. And it's boring, you know. After the first few times, you can kind of take it seriously. You have a debate. After the same thing happens over and over again, you have to take a step back and realize you're having a debate with morons here. Well, what is this? The assumption that we're going to cut, the way that Obama and all these people discuss this, they think that the only thing that's going to happen is that the government is going to tax a little more and spend a little less, and that's it. But that's not all that happens. When the government does this, raise taxes and cut spending, it sets in motion all kinds of other things. Number two, the rest of the world is impacting the American economy in all kinds of ways that are different. For example, American companies continue to move both blue-collar and white-collar jobs out of the United States, particularly to Asia, but to other parts of the world. All of that together will determine what the government's budget is like. So when you see a projection, we're going to cut the deficit, this is fantasy. Nobody on Wall Street knows what's going to happen 3 months from now, let alone over the next 10 years. So a projection over 10 years of anything in economics is to be taken with a grain of salt bigger than the Empire State Building. It's just silly stuff designed to make what you're advocating look like a great idea with wonderful numbers, when in fact there's no basis for you to have this certainty. And all the Europeans, the early years of the, for example, the terrible austerity imposed on Greece, that's what they said. The Greek government is going to lay off lots of workers, which it did. It's going to raise taxes on people, which it did. It's going to cut government programs drastically. And in Greece, they're adding the other thing. They're selling off their government property. You know, we're wondering whether the Acropolis will become renamed Disneyland or something in the near future.
Thinking by it by pieces, we're looking at the Parthenon as a possibility. Yeah,
absolutely. Good deal, too.
I understand that Bloomberg is going to buy Central Park.
But the point is, they thought that that would bring the deficit down. In fact, it made the deficit worse, because the collapse of the Greek economy decimated the revenues of governments way beyond what they had foreseen. By their own hand, they brought that to bear, and that undid the numbers they had so glowingly predicted.
Well, Rick, when we had lunch together last week, you made a point that I want to share with our listening audience, because you talked about the political side of this economic situation. And I'd like to ask you about that, because Law and Disorder, in the 8 years that we've been on the air, have emphasized the steady, intractable reduction of democratic rights for people in the country. And the point you made to me at lunch, and what I'd like you to expand upon, what's the relationship between the economic austerity and the loss of democratic rights that we've experienced since 9/11?
As you go into that, you know, we've talked about this before with you. It's an added point to what Michael's saying. Is you come from Europe a lot. We read in the paper the protests everywhere in the streets. My European friends who come to the United States and look at us, and our situation economically is very bad off, and unemployment. Why aren't there people in the streets? And they may be related, they may not be, but there's something going on that we cannot understand here.
Well, let me try. First, the political effects of this crisis are now becoming clear in Europe in a way that ought to put those in charge of our world on notice. Let me give you just a rough idea. I'll start with the most extreme example, Greece. Greece now, in the public polling, is giving the number one position, the largest single party, is called the Syriza Party. The Syriza Party is an extreme left-wing party that until 2012 was getting 2, 3, 4% of the vote in the elections where it contested. It is against austerity blanket. It is in favor of refusing to pay the debts that Greece has accumulated on the grounds that they were illegal, immoral, and everything else, and they are not responsible.
Fattening.
And fattening. Why do I bring this up? They went in 2012 from roughly 3 or 4% of the vote to now polling 35%, 40% of the vote. Unbelievable. The two major parties in Greece, the equivalent there of the Republicans and Democrats here, New Democracy and the Greek Socialist Party, were the names of those two parties, had alternated who was the prime minister every few years in the way that Republicans and Democrats play that game here. They now together are barely getting the vote that Syriza, the extreme left party, gets by itself. The Greek people, the majority of people who gave their votes to those two mainline parties, now that majority refuses to give its votes to the two mainline parties. That ought to be a wake-up call.
Look at Italy in that.
Italy.
Two mainline parties didn't get the
two
majority.
Two mainline parties pushed away by an upstart,
comedian.
A public comedian, Beppe Grillo, whose major advisor, if people should know, is a Nobel Prize winning theater writer of pieces of theater named Dario Fo, whose political affiliations were with the Italian Communist Party. And it should be remembered that Mr. Grillo is a complicated fellow, understood.
I would say that because his immigration policies would be anathema to the people sitting at this table.
That's right. It's all kinds of complicated. But what it is a rejection of the status quo, rejection of Italian politics, and above all, the big loser in the election was Mr. Monti, who was a banker in charge of the austerity program. And there's no question that the people of Italy said no, as the people in Portugal did last weekend with those enormous demonstrations. Mr. Hollande, the head of France, announced no more austerity steps. He had been flirting with them for a while. So it's unmistakable where it's going. And it's all because of upsurges from below. Politicians in Europe are beginning to get the following idea. I, fill in the blank, hitched my wagon to austerity. And that wagon is sinking, and they're beginning to bail as they realize their own futures are gone. Here in the United States, things are different. The austerity is going full force. They don't have the blowback from the unions, the communists, socialists, and all these new political developments. In Germany, the new party was called for a while the Left Party, and it's still important, but the big upstart called themselves the Pirates, the Piraten Party, which is like a Beppe Grillo kind of phenomenon. And and even in England, you're getting these kinds of things. But in any case,
those US, I understand, in Europe, as opposed to here, they have a multi-party system.
Right.
So that you can actually form around somebody like a comedian and get a percent
a
and make a difference.
You you sit in
the parliament.
That's right.
Here, it's Democrats or Republicans, winner takes all. So,
but I think what the United States is a little bit different. We haven't had the opposition here, and what we've had instead is a circling of the wagons. We're going to impose austerity, and we're going to get the civil liberty constraints and so forth to allow us to force it if and when the blowback comes, especially now that we've seen in Occupy Wall Street the potential for doing that. So let me answer the question that Michael raises about his European friends wondering why not here. I've spent a lot of time trying to come up with an answer for that. I'm asked it all the time. I think Americans are in a state of shock. They are like the proverbial deer in the headlights of an oncoming car, dimly aware that disaster is coming, but somehow unable to act, to get out of the way, to run away or whatever. And let me explain why. We are a people who have now for several generations been told every generation will do better than the one before. If you get a good education, if you work real hard, you're going to have that suburban house, and you're going to be able to send your kids to college, and you're going to have a decent vacation, and you're going to. And it was true enough, or close enough, for a large number of people that it became the reigning dogma. Even people who were poor had a kind of vision in America that they wouldn't be that much longer, and that therefore they would like all those lovely privileges that rich people have because of the belief they would pretty soon be joining them, and even if they didn't, their kids would. And what has now happened is that for 30 years, and it's taken 30 years, slowly the mentality is dawning on the American people that that's not true anymore, that it's over, that the children of this generation are not even going to live as well as their parents. We have an entire generation now for 20 years of people who cannot get a college education without building up a level of debt that is unmanageable and has no precedent, at the same time that they're looking at a job market that is lousy in terms of the jobs they can get and lousy in terms of the income they can get if they're so lucky as to get a decent job. The combination of taking your best educated people and putting them in this debt vice on the other side of which is a lousy job prospect is producing anger, rage, but at first it's stymied. It's just shock. This wasn't supposed to happen. This wasn't the script. This wasn't what I signed up for. This wasn't what my parents promised me. This wasn't what the school told me would be the result of my working hard and doing well and going to college and going to graduate school or whatever else I did in my life. And there's a kind of confusion about what to do and how to handle it that's there and growing. The left in this country, the left criticism of the status quo is enormous. That's why Occupy explodes in 3 months. That's why you get these bizarre polls in which half of the people polled say they would prefer socialism to capitalism. But it's not because they know what socialism is, to be blunt and honest. Right. It's because they don't like what the status quo is. They know that's called capitalism, and almost anything would be better for them, which is in a sense like the voters of Beppe Grillo. They're voting against the status quo.
We're also getting a lot of anarchism in its many shades because people are just completely frustrated with the capitalist system.
Right. They don't like
and they don't really know what socialism is.
Right.
And they just say,
anarchism,
well,
socialism is an alternative. Right. And they're angry not only at the financial structure, but at the government, which seems as dysfunctional as the economics. So they kind of thumb their nose at the whole thing. But here's what I think the bottom line of all of this said. Don't sell the American people short. You may be stuck in the headlights for a while. You may be in a state of shock. But building behind or underneath that shock is a level of anger and political criticism and hostility to the status quo that I think will surprise us. As we were surprised by the speed and spread of Occupy Wall Street, whether the next phase is the same movement part two, or what takes a new name, is not interesting.
It's you've said this before in a way, and what you've said about it is you had a worry last time as the crash happened that this anger could go in a negative direction. It could go in a direction of fascism. Yeah. And the question, what you're putting forward, it seems to be, you were saying maybe it'll go in a socialist way, but isn't that a worry still?
Sure. And I think the one thing we can be sure of is we're going to have both those ways. Syriza is the dominant representation of this perspective in Greece. It's left wing. But coming up behind Syriza, still much smaller than Syriza, is something called the Golden Dawn Party in Greece. And they've decided that the crisis of Greece is the fault of the immigrants and will be solved if you expel them. Well, we could make a list of the classic alternatives. When a society begins to fall apart because its economic system doesn't work, you can be sure that alongside those who see the failed economic system for what it is, who expose it and who reveal it and who analyze it, there are going to be people who don't want to go in that direction, who are going to prefer, for all kinds of reasons, to line up to blame the conventional scapegoats. And we all know what they are. Immigrants are a standard option for that. Being ferociously angry at the government as if it were an independent player in this theater is another popular one in our country. Being angry at black people, being angry at Jews, being angry at southern Europeans if you're a northern one. In England, the fascists are beginning to rise because they blame everything on continental Europe, and all the English should get rid of the relationship to Europe because the Europeans are... That's a way to express the mass disaffection with capitalism in a way that doesn't threaten capitalism. And of course, that's going to be supported by capitalists, number one, because they see the upset that their own system is calling, and they sure want to deflect it in a direction that doesn't threaten their system, especially when the left is emerging to make just that point. And I suspect that we will have in the United States, as we did in the 1930s, those who remember your history, you had the CIO, you had the socialists and the communists, but you also had Townsend, you also had Father Coughlin, you had the other side of the political ledger, Huey Long in Louisiana, and so on. And we're going to have that again. We are not going to escape the turmoil. Occupy was the first sign of that. Tea Party in its own way is a sign of that. And more of that is coming because all the conditions that brought those into play have in fact deteriorated.
Wouldn't bringing manufacturing back to the United States solve a lot of these problems?
If it were done on a massive scale, and the prospects for that, with all due respect, are zero.
So in terms of a political solution, and I know you've thought about this a lot, how do we get from where we are to where we want to be? How do we get an American, say, Syriza formation? I mean, what do you tell people when they ask you that?
And what are the demands? I mean, you know, how are you going to make it better? If you can't get manufacturing back, what are you going to do, make more cheeseburgers?
Well, here's the question. We are permitting...
I'm hungry.
We are permitting corporations to make decisions with devastating social consequences for which they are not held accountable and for which they do not have to pay. We allow American companies to close the factory in New Jersey, to end the office in Santa Fe, New Mexico, to close the warehouse in Alabama or whatever, and leave. Leave the workers behind without a job, leave their families bereft of the income, leave their communities without the taxpayers needed to sustain what the community does. We permit that. First, Americans should understand other countries don't. Let me give you an example of a capitalist country. You don't even have to change the system. A capitalist country doing better than almost everyone else in the current crisis, who is distinguished by the laws that limit what its corporations can do. Germany is an example, if you want to pick an obvious one, which puts much, much more limits. German company has to give notice a year in advance. It has to get the approval of the trade union and of the local political council before it can move. It has to make compensation payments. There are all kinds of restrictions. And one of the reasons Germany is doing better is it held on to its factories and its offices way better than other societies, putting it in a position where, to make it as dramatic as I can, unemployment in Germany now, in a depressed Europe, is 5%, not as in Spain, 28%, not as in Greece, 27%, and on and on. They've been able to do that. Why in the United States do we believe that quote-unquote freedom requires that you leave a private enterprise free to get up and leave, and its workers free to wallow in the disaster that comes from that? Where's the freedom of people for having a job? Where's the freedom of a community to have the funding for its school kids? Where is that? Bizarre in the United States, the way we calculate and think about freedom, number one. But as to what we would do, I don't think, frankly, that we in this country could do very much with the kind of rule-ridden regime of regulations that the Germans have always been specialists in, for reasons good and bad, and with outcomes that are good and bad. We don't work like that. We don't follow rules like that. We don't impose rules like that. We would have to do something different. We would have to change the way corporations make decisions so that they don't make decisions like pulling up stakes from Cleveland so that it's a devastated city, or Detroit that is so devastated by what the freedom of auto companies to leave that this last week the governor of Michigan took over the city of Detroit so that even their elected representatives no longer have the right to do what elected representatives were elected to do, which is run the finances of the city that elected them. Freedom in America, once again. Any case, here's what we have to do. We have to change the way businesses are organized. That's what we have to do. If the workers in every business took it over, ran it, the way we already have cooperatives all around the United States, been doing that for years, as American as apple pie, the co-op is, well, here we have a workers' co-op. Let me just take you through how it would be different. If workers together, collectively, made the decisions, became their own board of directors, which is what the idea is, do you think they would close the factory and move it to China? No. You know why not? Because that's nuts. They're not going to destroy their own jobs, their own community, and their own family. They ain't going to do it. Whoa. Then we don't need a regulation because it ain't going to happen. Number one. Number two, many Americans think one of our biggest problems, and I agree, is the extraordinary inequality of wealth and income we have in the United States. Okay. We bemoan that every 20 years in the United States. I remember Michael Harrington back in 1960 writes a book called The Other America, and ta-da! Suddenly we discover we got a lot of poor people. Then we forget about it for 10 or 15 years, and another person gets a Nobel Prize or a Pulitzer Prize by saying, you know what? Turn over the rock, lots of poor people, there we are, all around us, we all knew. Okay, how do you get rid of an inequality of wealth and income? We have tried progressive income taxes and rules and limits, none of them work. Every time we do it, rich people figure out how to escape them and do a very good job. Tax exemptions, tax deductions, foreign accounts, Cayman Island account, you know the game, you've all read about it. Stop. Here's the easy way to do it. Transform the enterprises so that the workers inside them make the decisions. You know why? Because the largest single source of inequality of wealth and income is the distribution of profits made in every enterprise. Where do they go? Do they go to the payment to the dividend holders or shareholders? Do they go in huge salary packages for the top executives? Yeah, that's why they go where they go. And that's how inequality grows. That's how it grew over the last 30 years. Every statistic shows it. If workers themselves collectively made the distribution, you think they would give multi-million dollar packages to a few executives while everybody else can't send their kid to college? No chance. There's a way to change the inequality of wealth and income from the ground up in a sustainable way, independent of regulations or anybody's desire or capacity to escape them. So, these are two big problems, the loss of our jobs and the inequality of what's been done since. Here's a way to change them that takes us from the top-down hierarchical capitalist organization of production to a collective, self-governing, I'm my own boss, cooperative form of organization. I think the majority of American people, given half a chance, would vote for it, support it, prefer to work in a place like that, and prefer to buy the products that come from a place like that.
Rick Wolf, on that note, we're going to close another incredible interview with you. Absolutely incredible. I mean, the three of us are sitting here completely mesmerized, as usual. And really, thank you. I mean, you've done great, not just on our station, but I know you're speaking all across the country these days and the world.
Thank you all for having me. It's always fun to be on this program and to have these conversations, and I really appreciate all that you do to make it possible.
And one last thing, Rick. We're going to link to the show that you did with Bill Moyers. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.